joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Yesterday, Connecticut Senator Chris Dodd said he and his Republican counterpart were close to reaching agreement to send a financial reform bill to the floor for debate. But this morning, the GOP appeared unified in opposition to some measures of the bill. Tomorrow, the head of giant investment bank Goldman Sachs testifies on his firm's role in the financial meltdown. Recently released memos show Goldman made money by betting in favor of a real estate bubble collapse. Joining me in the studio to talk about what's in the Dodd bill, what the legislation would mean for financial institutions, and for you, University of Maryland Professor Michael Greenberger. Stacy Caper, she's reporter for American Banker newspaper and McClatchy newspaper's Kevin Hall. Throughout the hour, we'll welcome your calls, your questions. Join us by email to drshow@wamu.org. Give us a call at 800-433-8850. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Michael Greenberger, what can you tell us about these Goldman Sachs memos?
Well, Goldman Sachs actually in late 2007, early 2008 was rather proud of the fact that they had decided to bet against the subprime mortgage market. In other words, they took positions that would profit from the fact that people who took these subprime mortgages would default and be thrown out of their houses. They're now saying, and their emails to this effect, Senator Levin, who's chair of the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, is going to hold a hearing tomorrow. I believe he's bringing seven Goldman executives in, including the CEO. And Senator Levin has unearthed emails which said that Goldman knew early on, relatively early on, that this market was going to collapse. And they arranged a series of bets. And they were nothing more than bets. They had nothing to do with putting money into the real economy. They found counterparties who would bet that the subprime mortgages would hold up, and they and some of their investors, now this SEC action that has gained so much publicity, one leader of a hedge fund said, look, I want to arrange a bet that certain identified mortgages will collapse because they look so weak to me. I don't own those mortgages. I have nothing to do with those mortgages, but I just want to make a bet. And in that case, Goldman found this little insurance company regulated out of Maryland called ACA, who was talked into taking the bet, the SEC alleges, because they thought the hedge fund was on their side of the bet, not the other side. Now, this market is dark, opaque, nobody understands it. But if this had been a bet on Las Vegas, where odds had been given, it would have shown up as effectively betting that the New York Yankees could beat the Little League World Series champions. But this little insurance company was like someone who didn't know anything about baseball. And I think what has driven the American people crazy here is that it's one thing for the mortgages to collapse, where people really gave out money and either in good faith or bad faith tried to get people into homes. Three times the amount of money at stake here was the betting that went on whether those mortgages would be paid and not paid. And the final thing I would say is all the taxpayer money that has gone to bail out the banks, a huge proportion of that was to serve as the lender of last resort to the casino operation. It had nothing to do with creating jobs, mortgages, or anything else.
Michael Greenberger, he's professor at the University of Maryland. Turning to you now, Kevin Hall, how do you see it? Was Goldman Sachs simply covering their bets in a legitimate way? Were they trying to make money off this assumed collapse of the real estate bubble? How do you see it?
I think a clarification on what the professor said. Also, there are two things. There's the SEC investigation and these emails. They're kind of distinct things. They didn't do something that others weren't doing as well. This doesn't make it right, and we're certainly, as a news organization, has been as tough on Goldman as anybody, but they were not a big player in this market. Merrill Lynch, Citibank, Lehman, and Bear Stearns were the big guys in this sort of activity. But yes, they traditionally hedge in both directions, and then they, on net, they're playing the win and the loss, and they come out ahead on some, behind on others. But as the professor rightly noted, what does this have to do with capital formation? What does this have to do with creating capital, you know, for our system? And it has become a casino-like atmosphere in which there's not, for instance, the synthetic CDOs that are in the heart of the crisis of the heart of the SEC investigation. These aren't even, you're not actually betting on the underlying asset. You're betting on you're twice removed from it. So you've got a market that's four times the size of the actual underlying asset, which is kind of insane when you think about it.
So Goldman is certainly denying the allegations. They have said that they did not take a large directional bet against the U.S. housing market.
Yeah, I think they're saying they were a market maker, and their position is probably there's a long and a short. They're in the middle, bringing buyers and sellers together. What's different in the SEC investigation, however, is they had someone handpick. You know, and I think for the average person, they kind of handpicked the mortgages. They went by zip code, by FICO score. So they tailor made this deal. The rating agencies claim they weren't even made aware of this. So the people who were given it a AAA rating, the hedge fund, the Paulson Company, had access to information that the other investor on the other side of the deal didn't have. The rating agencies who gave it their blessing didn't have. And I think that's why this is getting so much scrutiny.
And that's the voice of Kevin Hall. He's national economics correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. He was a 2010 Pulitzer Prize finalist for national reporting. Michael Greenberger, do you want the last word on
that?
Well,
yeah, I would just say the Financial Times, right after the SEC brought its action, said that AIG, by the way, a company that you and I have a large ownership interest in, is readying a lawsuit to sue Goldman for $6 billion because Goldman, not some hedge fund, created the same kind of lock bet that couldn't lose, and had AIG take the other side of it to the tune of $6 billion. We have put $180 billion into AIG to cover those kinds of bets. I would agree that Goldman is not the only perpetrator here. Before this thing is over, we are going to see that these examples are poster children for a way that business was done on Wall Street, creating bets that could not fail. And then when the casino, that is the sucker counterparty who took the opposite end of the bet, couldn't make the payment, you and I threw in and made that bet good 100 cents on the dollar. And that's why the American people are so outraged today.
Kevin.
And I think what makes it most egregious in the case of Goldman is they're kind of a farm team for the U.S. Treasury Department. It's kind of a revolving door between Goldman Sachs and Treasury and White House Chief of Staff, and it's tentacles throughout government. I think that's in part why Goldman it matters more when it's Goldman.
All right. Do join us, 800-433-8850. I'd very much like to hear your views on this issue. Stacey Caper, let's talk about the financial regulatory reform proposal. Give us a status on the test vote.
Well, Republicans and Democrats still say that it's unlikely they will reach a deal today before this vote this evening. They still hope to reach a final deal eventually.
And what is the vote this evening intended to do?
It's a procedural vote to decide whether they will continue debate on the legislation. Republicans have said they won't support this bill at this point unless they can see some changes in their direction and don't feel very confident they'll be able to get those changes before tonight. However, they eventually do want to get to a deal, and they could come back to this bill as soon as Wednesday.
What kinds of changes do they want before they'll debate?
Republicans say that they still believe the bill does not end the debate over too big to fail, and that they would like to see the government's ability to prop up or assist a failing institution further limited. The principal issue that they have focused on has been this $50 billion fund, which they have referred to as a honeypot. Ironically, it's actually the financial institutions that would be paying into this fund in advance. And clearly, the financial institutions are not interested in pre-funding a $50 billion kitty to support their own failure. However, the administration has not supported this measure either. They have said it could be a moral hazard. It sets up an expectation that if a firm is going down, there is this expectation there could be some assistance.
So if the administration itself is not particularly high on that $50 billion fund, and that seems to be one of the stumbling blocks for Republicans, why is it still in there?
I think it's a negotiating chip at this point. It's very likely to come out of the bill. It was not in Senator Chris Dodd's original draft. He's the banking committee chairman and the lead Democrat negotiating this legislation. It's sort of a sacrificial lamb at this point, it seems.
Stacey Caper, she is a reporter for American Banker newspaper. It's an independent publication, not affiliated with the American Banking Association. Short break, and when we come back, we'll hear more about the bill and your calls. Welcome back. We're talking about the financial regulatory reform bill currently up before the Senate. We shall see whether sufficient compromise is reached by today to go forward with debate. Michael Greenberger, what does it need to go forward?
Well, it needs 60 votes, and the Democrats only have 59, and the Republicans up to this point have signed a letter saying they will, unless there is a compromise and a bipartisan bill, they will vote against this bill. And as we were talking about during the break, I think the Democrats have a very smart strategy here, which is to try and get the Republicans, all 41 of them, on record as not wanting to debate a very good bill that would regulate Wall Street.
But how risky is that for Republicans, Stacey? Americans are furious with Wall Street.
Well, Republicans are betting that if they say they are trying to protect the taxpayer from future government bailouts, they feel they're safe in making this argument to block debate at this point. But there are several Republicans who really do want to see a bill, and I think if they vote no today, it will be very difficult for them to vote no the next time the bill comes up, which could be later this week.
Kip. What gets lost in the mix, the stated purpose is to no more bailouts, but in fact, if you look at the bill in its totality, all the things it does, it creates a financial regulation scheme so that you don't get to the point where you need a bailout. This is in the absolute last case that you've managed to avoid all these other, clear all these hurdles to collapse, then you still have this bailout fund. And I think if you look at the history, the new numbers have come out, the bailout has not cost nearly as much as it was supposed to. It actually did stem the panic, did halt the panic. It's done pretty much what it's done. And I think one of the fighting points over this, it's called 13-3. The Federal Reserve has these broad discretionary powers. And what the Republicans are saying is you have to give the FDIC and the Fed absolutely no room to move, never another bailout. And I think Treasury and the Fed are saying, well, we need a little bit of flexibility because you don't know what the next crisis is going to look like.
From my observation, this bill that the Senate Democratic majority has crafted, it's not perfect. And I am, before I came here and as I leave, am arguing for stronger protections. But relatively speaking, this is a very strong bill. Had it been in place in 2005, it would have prevented the meltdown. And I believe that any hesitation about endorsing this bill or defeating it is only Greece right now is in dire financial strait. Every day, you hear one day they need $30 billion, next day they need $60 billion. The euro is sinking. We could be on the precipice of another dip. And unless we get this kind of tough legislation that cabins Wall Street, we are cruising for a bruising.
Stacy, how strong is this bill?
Well, what's remarkable about this bill is typically the Senate, because you do need to get bipartisan agreement to get something through. Typically, the Senate is the place where bills become weaker as they go along. But what we have seen in the last week is this bill has just become stronger. For example, the Senate Agriculture Committee last week passed this derivatives bill, which would say that if you're a large financial institution, you must spin off your derivatives trading desk. This would be a huge profit loss for the major institutions. This is where they do their swaps trading, is within the bank. And this provision has survived. It got one Republican to support it. And Senator Dodd has agreed to put that into his base bill, which would be voted on this evening if they get to that point. So it's interesting that this bill has just gotten tougher as it has gone along.
What about the banks themselves? Could they be forced out of derivatives if this bill goes through?
Well, they'd be forced to spin off their operations and have it as a standalone business. And I think if you look at the profits that they've reported in the first quarter in the last couple of weeks, trading, both derivatives and equity trading, has been about 80% of their profit center. So it's clearly that they're not making their money on commercial deposits. And I think this is trying to separate these two things. The Volcker Rule, as you rightly mentioned, the Volcker Rule is stronger than what's in the House bill. It creates, you spin off proprietary trading, and then the Senate Ag bill spins off derivatives. So there's going to be a firewall.
Here is an email from Diane. She says, what is particularly galling to the American electorate is the spectacle of former Goldman Sachs executive who still to this day holds sway over White House decisions regarding the financial crisis and the resolution of same. If he's talking about Timothy Geithner never served on Wall Street.
He never
he's
served.
He's talking about who?
Well, I mean, there are the chief of staff to Timothy Geithner was the former Goldman Sachs lobbyist. The Goldman Sachs bank has filled both the Clinton administration, George W. Bush administration, and this administration with many people in very important jobs. However, this has not been a uniform truth. The most serious advocate for reform of the derivatives is a man named Gary Gensler, who is chair of the CFTC. He was, at the time, the youngest partner, when Goldman was a partnership, ever elected to the partnership. He retired at the age of 39 to come down and work with his mentor, Bob Rubin. When he was here in the Clinton...
Bob Rubin, having been
the chair of co-chair of Goldman Sachs and then Secretary of the Treasury under Clinton, Gensler has come back as one of the most courageous fighters for reform we have now. And he is a former Goldman executive. Time magazine this week has done a full profile out of him, for him. If it hadn't been for Gensler, a lot of the good things in this bill would not be there.
Do you agree, Stacy?
Well, what's interesting is that the Goldman debate. It has become such a flashpoint on Capitol Hill. I mean, all of the Wall Street institutions have really just been marred by this whole crisis. Having all of the revelations in the last week about Goldman, regardless of if the SEC charges hold or not, it comes at a tremendously vulnerable time for the industry as it debates this legislation on the Hill. And it is really hard for the financial institutions to defend themselves.
And here's an email from David at the University of Colorado at Denver. What did politicians and journalists learn from the Enron case, and to what degree was that knowledge put to use to prevent or report on the financial malfeasance we find on Wall Street today? Kevin?
Learned a lot, did very little. You could say the same thing about long-term capital management and that crisis as well. We seem to have institutional amnesia. And I think in the Enron case, it was followed by Amaranth, which was a big natural gas trader that blew up, and that had affected the prices of everyday folks, what they're paying for their natural gas and heating, and distorted markets more broadly. And we seemed unwilling to do a thing about it. There was something that I found rather humorous last week when the Chamber of Commerce, which has been a very strong lobbyist against this reform effort, put out a letter to the president before he gave his speech up in New York and said, you know, that this legislation needs to get it right for the next 75 years. Well, that's the whole point. We shouldn't be doing this once every 75 years. We should be more on top of it.
Here's some interesting stats about two-thirds of Americans support stricter regulations on the way banks and other financial institutions conduct their business, and that's according to a new Washington Post ABC News poll. Surely Democrats and Republicans are listening to this, Michael?
Yes, and I think the Republicans thought they could evade signing up to tough regulation through, I mean, this has now become a famous mantra. Senator McConnell, the minority leader for the Republicans in the Senate, said, well, this bill is only going to be, quote, another bailout. And it was demonstrated that the Republican pollster Frank Luntz said the only way you can escape voting against this bill is to convince the American people it's another bailout.
It's a bailout.
And the American people, aided by this Goldman, SEC Goldman case, are not buying that. They see this legislation as preventing them from economic insecurity, job loss, and having to fund the wealth of Wall Street bankers.
All right. Now, just to clarify, here is an email from Mark in Little Rock, Arkansas. He says, what is the GOP's problem with the fund to dismantle banks in this bill? I've heard they claim it's another bailout, a word that, quite frankly, I'm sick of hearing. I've also heard the banks themselves will be putting the money in this fund, not taxpayers. So explain the truth, Stacy.
Well, it is. Mark makes very good points in that email. It is true that this fund would be paid for by financial institutions. Now, critics have said if you have any sort of fund in advance, the market will not discipline itself and conduct itself in a safe and sound manner. It will act with the belief that there is this support that would come to it if it should start to go down.
But wouldn't the banks themselves rebel if you had that kind of misbehavior just sort of allowing themselves free will?
Well, it's clearly not in the institution's interest to need government support, to be on the brink of failure. It's not, doesn't serve any economic benefit, but this has become a piece that the Republicans especially have been arguing is a flaw with the legislation, and they say it sets up the expectation in the marketplace for this moral hazard. Now, this fund seems very unlikely to stay in the bill the way it is now. And as I've said, the administration does not support it either. So it has not had much support on either side of the debate.
Michael Greenberger, explain to us preemption and what's going on there.
Well, the concern throughout this bill is that to the extent they give the government power to do things, the federal government, they are in the same breath in many instances taking that power away from the states. For example, the existing laws preempt the states from enforcing their gaming laws. And I mentioned earlier that all of this stuff is nothing more than betting. Well, under the existing law, the betting was deregulated on the federal level, and then they preempted states from applying their gaming laws. In other words, this bet that is part of the SEC case where Paulson creates a bet that he's likely to win, that the market will collapse, finds a sucker to take the other end of the bet. Were it not for the preemption of state gaming laws, Nevada would probably be coming in and saying, hey, that should be done in a casino. And by the way, casinos are better regulated than these Wall Street institutions because the casinos have to set aside money to pay off their bets.
Michael Greenberger, he's professor at the University of Maryland School of Law. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And Kevin Hall, does the bill do anything about poor underwriting standards?
Well, as envisioned, it would create a consumer finance protection agency that would be housed at the Federal Reserve. In the House bill, this is a standalone independent agency. In the Dodd bill, it's a independent agency with its own funding source and everything, but still housed within the Fed. This body would oversee all consumer credit, so that would be credit cards, mortgages, payday loans. That's questionable whether that's going to stay in or out, and car loans, et cetera. So it's going to create a focus and an attention. The Canadians do this, and they do a pretty good job of it. They don't have teeth in it, and that's when you talk to the Canadians, they complain our system doesn't have the teeth that your bill is going to give it. And I think that's one of the questions as we go forward this week. Will they be able to enforce it? Will that enforcement depend on a council of regulators, so to speak?
What about the ratings agencies? Does this bill address them at all?
Before I answer that, if I could just follow up on the previous question about underwriting, the House bill actually does have underwriting reform in the bill. It's based off of legislation the House was able to pass in 2007 to respond to the mortgage crisis. And the Senate bill at this point does not have specific underwriting rules in it. However, it does have a requirement that says there's a 5% risk retention of mortgages that are underwritten or packaged, that the packager of the loan or the underwriter of the loan would have to maintain some part of that risk, considered skin in the game.
I see.
The way the legislation is currently written, there is flexibility for the regulators to exempt out certain types of loans if they think it's a safe loan, a 30-year fix that is well underwritten. The financial institutions have been fighting to remove this fiercely. They say it will force them to hold much more capital on their books, and they argue it will not allow them to lend as much as they could otherwise. I think at this point that provision's likely to stay in the bill. Additionally, Senator Bob Corker, who is a Republican who's been very eager to see a bill get through Congress, has said that he will offer an amendment on the floor that would include some base underwriting standards and ban some of the more dangerous seen practices in underwriting, such as prepayment penalties and things of that sort. I think if a Republican were to offer some underwriting standards, that's actually something that could get attached to this bill.
And what about the ratings agencies, Michael?
Well, I think the rating agencies is a tremendous problem that is not fully solved by this. The SEC will be given authority over them and will be checking to see. The problem essentially with the rating agencies was you had a terrible investment, and the banks would take the investment to the rating agencies and effectively bribe them into giving it a AAA.
How would they do that?
Well, if you read, actually on Friday, Senator Levin held hearings on this. The rating agency said this was money from heaven for them. All they had to do was give a AAA rating, and the money from the banks kept flowing in.
So how are consumers going forward to believe in any ratings process, Kevin?
Well, the rating agencies, one of the inherent problems of the rating agencies, it's an issuer pays model. And there's very little in American business that works this way, that I pay you to give me a rating. I mean, that's the inherent conflict right there. They're not going to transition away from it. The Barney Frank bill on the House side tries to move away from such reliance on this to a broader range of measurements. The SEC, ironically, the SEC got new powers in 2006 to look at rating agencies, but their methodology was treated as proprietary, and they couldn't look at that. That's going to change under this bill. More enforcement teeth, once-a-year inspections, new staffing for the SEC. So things are going to happen, but I think the damage has been done. I think the credibility of the rating agencies, I mean, the probability of a default on a AAA-rated bond had been, correct me, Professor, but I think less than 1%.
Absolutely.
So I think the damage that they've inflicted on themselves from giving these creative ratings, I think is going to be hard to come back from.
And we're talking basically here about Standard & Poor's and Moody's
and Fitch.
All right. Michael Greenberger, Stacy Caper, Kevin Hall, they're here to answer your questions. We'll take just a short break. When we come back, we'll open the phones.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the German Embassy and the German Information Center, whose Germany.info publishes news and politics, culture and lifestyle at Germany.info, by the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at MelvilleTrust.org, and by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR.
An award-winning Australian novelist on a 21st century moral dilemma. A man at a Sunday barbecue slaps a misbehaving child who's not his own, triggering different reactions among friends and family. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And welcome back. It's time for us to open the phones. We'll go first to Andy, who's in Dayton, Ohio. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane. Let's assume that there are always going to be bettors out there. Go back to the Hunt brothers, go back to the Japanese real estate bubble, go to the dot-com bubble, go to last year's crisis. What can we do, or what does this bill do, what can any bill do to isolate that activity so that the rest of the economy and the rest of the economic activity that that we want to do is more of a house built on rock than a house built on sand? Is there any way that could possibly isolate this kind of gambling?
And that's precisely what Robert Samuelson is writing about this morning in the Washington Post, looking forward, Michael.
Well, first of all, the bill does a lot by indirection that is very good. It makes the gambling more transparent. It requires the gamblers, like casinos, to have capital to back their bets. Most shockingly, out of the Senate Agriculture Committee, there's a prohibition placed on the CFTC from approving contracts that would be regulated that are gaming contracts. Now, my view is that's going to be very hard to enforce at this level for technical reasons. And what I would urge, and I would, if listeners are interested in stopping the casino and being the banker of last resort for casino-like activity, they should pursue their members of Congress to make state gaming laws apply to these transactions. If you want to stop this stuff in its tracks, let the state gambling regulators have a crack at this. Most of this stuff would be illegal in the vast majority of states.
And Kevin, what Samuelson is saying is that these banks are really too big to fully insulate the public from this kind of event occurring again.
Right, right. And I think one of the things that happens under this bill, both in the Senate Ag part on derivatives to the Volcker rule, which is in the Dodd bill itself, there's an effort to force banks to spin off the riskier behavior, separate it, insulate it. And then separate from that, the Federal Reserve is going to be in charge of looking at all systemically important institutions, including insurance companies, interestingly enough. And that they will be charged with looking at the risk to the system, and they can order the breakup, a dissolution of a big company if it doesn't do it itself.
Stacey.
One thing, though, that is interesting about that is that the regulators already had the power under prompt corrective action to break up institutions if they felt that they were too risky, and they didn't use this power. So one question is, you can put all these things into the legislation, and clearly we're going to be encouraging regulators to be much tougher. At this point, there's nothing that would specifically require the institution to be broken up. However, they're getting at it in other ways by this derivatives measure, saying you can't have the derivatives desk in the bank, by the proprietary trading ban. And I think you will see tougher amendments be offered on the floor. There are some members who want to put caps in the size of an institution's percentage of GDP, going back to the days of Glass-Steagall and putting up a wall between commercial and investment banking. And it will be very interesting in this environment to see if any of those provisions get added to the final bill.
Michael.
Yeah, you cannot underestimate what Senator Lincoln, as chair of the Agriculture Committee, did as a surprise to almost everybody, which is set up a system where the billion-dollar swaps betting will have to go outside of the banking institution. And amazingly, there's a lot of talk about Senator Grassley voted with the Democrats, and he said, the reason I'm voting for this bill is spinning out these gambling desks from commercial banks where my constituents put their money.
Well, I feel as an individual who has a checking account, who has a savings account at a local bank, I really want to know that that bank is going to not only protect my money, but is not going to be out there gambling with other people's money.
Yeah, the other thing, Diane, is if you send the swaps desks out of the banks,
yeah,
and the Volcker rule comes in,
right,
and takes the proprietary trading out of the banks, what banks are going to be forced to do is make loans to individuals and businesses. They don't want to do that because they don't think it's profit. That's what banks...
They don't make enough
they
money.
They don't make the huge bucks or have the guarantee if the loan goes bad, the taxpayer will take care of it. What this bill is slowly but surely doing, if it gets through, if the Republicans don't block it and there aren't compromising amendments made, is make banks go back to banking just like we knew them, where they take deposits and then loan people money to start businesses or go to school or something else.
Well, one point I just would like to add to that is that while I agree with everything that Professor Greenberger just said, this bill is not getting rid of these types of investments. It's not getting rid of derivatives. It's regulating them more tightly. What you might see is these types of investment vehicles just being moved out of the banks but still existing in
other
parts.
Well, I'd be happy to see that.
It's a good start, but I think the point is a good one. What happens after, how you regulate? I think your listeners would be quite shocked to know how little regulators actually know about these markets. For instance, there's something called a naked swap. I know that sounds like a dirty word, but it's not. You don't have to own the underlying asset. You can take a credit default swap and bet against the death of something.
Yeah,
right now, people can't tell you, a regulator can't tell you how much of the swaps market is naked swaps versus owning the underlying asset. Very basic things we don't even
know.
All
right, let's go to Los Angeles, California. Hi there, Rachel.
Hi, good morning. You mentioned Glass-Steagall, and that's been my point all along, is that the minute Glass-Steagall was no longer valid, everything seemed to have gone sour. My question is there anything that revives Glass-Steagall or something like a Glass-Steagall in the new bill, and if not, why?
Stacey.
The Volcker Rule is not exactly the same as Glass-Steagall, although by banning banks from being able to invest in private equity and hedge funds from doing this proprietary trading, it gets very close to Glass-Steagall. Now, there will likely be amendments on the floor of the Senate to go much further, and we'll see if those get included in the final bill.
All right. To Salisbury, North Carolina. Hi there, Patty.
Yeah, I don't quite understand the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac got blamed for a lot of the bad mortgages, but it sort of sounds like those are the casino chips these guys are using, that they kind of wanted bad mortgages, and they kind of made bad mortgages so these guys would have something to bundle up and to trade off.
Well, yes, I think the people who are arguing against overall reform of Wall Street say Wall Street didn't have anything to do with this. It was all Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which is sort of a whipping boy for people who don't want strong regulation. Yes, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae had their problems, but
they just follow the herd?
Absolutely. Mr. Mudd, who was the CEO in 2004, Daniel Mudd, said, when I took over, everybody said, hey, you got to get into this casino.
Yeah.
That's where the money's to be made. But there's no doubt that Fannie and Freddie need regulation. But any idea that they were the principal cause of this
Or leading the pack.
Or more sinister than that, the suggestion, which was a suggestion during the presidential campaign, that somehow the Community Reinvestment Act and lending to minorities was the real reason this happened, when in fact all the data shows that in the boom, the worst part of the housing boom, where all the abuse happened, people who were flipping homes, second homes, vacation homes, they didn't care about what the rate was for a subprime loan because they weren't going to hold the property or they'd refinance. So this idea that somehow minorities and Fannie and Freddie drove this process is just nuts.
Yeah, and the other thing that needs to be said, if we just had a problem with defaulted loans, this crisis would have been much, much less. We had three times the number of people betting on those loans, and it was the failed bets and the inability of the casino to pay that was the overwhelming cause of this crisis. If it had just been failed loans, this crisis could have been controlled and probably not has been as serious as it was.
And let's see, here's an email from Anne. Is there an objective source for the public to verify the stability of a bank? I'm terrified about the security of my savings.
Well, I think under the existing law, the answer is no. Because all this betting, if they're involved in it, is usually off balance sheet. And if you look at the financial statement of any institution that's betting this market or these markets or this kind of thing, you can't find where the exposure is. And as a matter of fact, that's why we had the credit crisis. People couldn't tell who had failed bets on their books, and no one wanted to lend them money.
And here's an email from Lloyd on that same subject, who says, it makes me crazy hearing this whole conversation referred to in terms of bets. If banking institutions are federally insured, we should be talking about investing and banking, not talking in Las Vegas terms. Stacey.
I think it's an interesting point that really reflects the frustration you see in the general public. One point I just wanted to touch back on as far as the previous question and concern about your safety with your deposits in a bank. The deposit insurance fund is in place, and if you have up to the thresholds of $250,000 right now, even if your bank fails, you will be protected. So just to make people feel comfortable that they will get their money back if their institution goes down.
And actually, smaller banks are failing at a higher rate than larger
That's
ones.
Quite
so
right.
The idea of moving out of a larger bank to a smaller one's not a safe bet either.
Yeah. All right. Let's go to Baltimore, Maryland. Good morning, Sarah.
Hi. Actually, part of my question was answered earlier, but can you speak a little more as to Glass-Steagall and possibly bringing it back? It's been a number of years since I was actually in the industry, but I got out around the same time that they started making all these strange investment vehicles.
And, of course, it was Phil Graham who played a role.
Well, in fairness, it was Phil Gramm, but that was a bill that was much considered. The Clinton administration supported it. It was a wave of euphoria from the 1990s as the stock market sailed upwards. I must tell you that there's probably no more there's no regulatory tool that is getting more bipartisan support than getting banks back to banking and away from speculation. As I said, Senator Grassley endorsed the little part of that that Senator Lincoln and the Democrats in the agriculture bill did. Senator McCain co-sponsored a bill with Maria Cantwell, a very liberal reformer from the state of Washington in the Senate. The Republicans really want to see banks go back to banking.
Well, could that mean reinstituting or reinvigorating Glass-Steagall? Is that a possibility?
Well, I think that's what the Volcker rule and the Senate spinoff
in
does. Because
another name.
You can't bring it back completely because banking's kind of evolved. We're in an electronic era now. So I think the feeling is you couldn't just lock, stock, and barrel bring it back. You have to bring your version out. I think that's what we have now.
Yeah. Diane, if I could just add one thing to that. The Volcker rule here, Volcker wants absolute prohibitions put into place. This asks for regulatory officials to have the ability to do it. I think what you're going to see is a movement on the Senate floor to go to absolute bans from doing things that put deposit holding institutions in jeopardy.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And now to Nantucket, Massachusetts. Good morning, Matt. You're on the air. Matt.
The whole mortgage thing that this is all based on, if I understand correctly, is only a quarter of the loss that our economy got. Without all the bets that everybody made, we wouldn't have gone into a recession, correct?
My own estimate is that these figures are hard to come by because the betting is opaque, not known to the public. But the New York insurance superintendent, Mr. DiNallo, who was responsible for trying in the first instance to save AIG, which was an insurance company he regulated, made a very convincing case in February of 2008 that three quarters of this market were not the actual mortgages causing the problem, but the betting on the mortgages.
Which really angers a lot of people who are suffering with mortgages because they're getting blamed for it when it wouldn't have happened.
The best. Kevin.
Yeah, and it also raises this question of had you addressed, Barney Frank tried very early to address this and was accused of, well, it's moral hazard, you can't do this, you're rewarding bad actors. The misnomer about bailouts is that you're bailing someone out. The truth is you're bailing out the system, and it's what we learned the hard way, and it's what the Europeans didn't seem to learn and why they're having such a problem with Greece now. Had they done it earlier, it would be a lot smaller problem.
Yeah, and NPR also did a thing months ago on how this all started, and they went back years ago, back in Clinton, and they knew they could get caught on gambling laws, and they went and changed the laws so before they released these derivatives. I mean, that's premeditated. It seems they should be able to go after them.
Yeah, well, the bank, as Diane knows, I was involved in an attempt to regulate these markets back in 97, 98, 99 with the chair of my commission, Brooksley Bourne, and we were fought off by Greenspan, Summers, Rubin, and Phil Gramm, and we were unsuccessful. But I can just tell you, at that point in time, unlike today, whatever the banks wanted, the banks got. And if they wanted to gamble and didn't want state gambling laws to apply to what they were doing, without batting an eye, Congress did that. And I think today we're in a better situation. But it's not perfect. As I said earlier, the state should be free to attack this stuff as illegal gambling, and that's still a prohibition in the statute.
Do you think that racketeering charges might ever be brought against these banks that did engage in this kind of risky behavior, the betting?
Well, let me just say this. It's been very hard up to now for the United States government to prove criminal conduct. There were two Bear Stearns hedge funds that were engaged in this betting, and the Eastern District of New York tried to prosecute them, and the jury let them off. That's why I think the SEC action is so smart. They're approaching this from civil fraud. It's a lower standard of proof. It could very well be, look, this is an opaque box that we don't know what's inside of it. When the box is opened, you could be talking about any kind of criminal prosecution.
Michael Greenberger, he's professor at the University of Maryland School of Law. Stacy Caper, reporter for American Banker newspaper. And Kevin Hall, he's national economics correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Thank you all. We'll see what happens this afternoon. Watch this space. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner.